Hello and welcome to Manga Splaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read manga before. Hosted by Deb Aoki, David Brothers, Christopher Butcher, and Chip Zdarsky. You can follow along with our reading list at mangasplaining.com. This week I'm going to be hosting. My name is Christopher Butcher. I do a lot of things in comics, but most recently I've been posting to a fun little Instagram called Japan High Low, where I share pictures I have taken in Japan, and it is hella calming. With me, as I mentioned, are Deb Aoki, David Brothers, and Chip Zdarsky. Maybe I'll let them introduce themselves. Deb, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'm Deb Aoki. I write about manga, and I am also a user experience designer, but that's what pays for me to buy lots of manga.
Don't quit your day job, folks.
That's for sure. David?
I'm David Brothers. I'm a manga editor and comics critic, which is sort of like being Satan and also a different Satan.
Satan and Lucifer, maybe.
Yeah, Satan and Lucifer. That's so much better. And I'm the editor. That's sad. And I've mostly been reading a bunch of Excalibur comics by Alan Davis over the past week. Ooh. But I made an exception for this week's subject.
It's very kind. And finally, our host slash test subject, Chip Zdarsky. Chip.
I'm Chip Zdarsky, and I'm your worst nightmare.
Nah. That's all. He's a kind soul. He's a kind soul.
A kind old soul.
Kind old soul. A good friend. So this week, this is technically episode one. This is our first episode of Manga Splaining. Episode zero, which we recorded last time, was, you know, getting to know us, getting to pick the first book, getting to chat. And now we're going to dig in. We're going to dig into, with all of our critical faculties, either way.
I feel like episode zero was just really laying out my deficiencies.
You know,
so it's all uphill from here.
It's all uphill from here. So the book we chose, and I, the other hosts were kind enough to let me choose the first book, was Akira Volume 1. And I chose it because it was, Akira as a property was a real breakthrough for me. It's the thing that, maybe got me started down the path of the Japanese comics and the Japanese animes that has, let's say, defined the last 10 years of my life. And so I wanted to start off, I wanted to talk a little bit about Akira for folks who aren't familiar with it. Just the publication history, because we're going to dig into the meat of what it's all about, I think, when we talk to each other. So Akira is a manga by author Katsuhiro Otomo. It was serialized twice monthly and sometimes even weekly from December 1982 through June 1990 in Japan in the Japanese manga magazine Young, published by Kodansha. Akira runs through six collected volumes. This is the first one, and this is what we're covering this week, totaling a little over 2,000 pages of work. And with chapters that average 20 pages or so, especially at the beginning, it's about the equivalent of 100 or so issues of your favorite contemporary superhero comic as one big, long, continuous story. One of the many things that makes Akira notable for Western audiences, though, is that the manga was translated into English and published by Marvel Comics at a time where not a lot of manga was translated in English and in America at all. It was also flipped. So my version is the flipped version, and it reads in the Western American orientation. So this happened in 1988. The manga came out in the West. And that was incidentally also when an animated film based on the Akira property was released in Japan. Of course, you know, that animated film, or anime, if you're cool, was released in theaters in North America on VHS. And it's on VHS that I actually discovered it through a friend passing me a tape in middle school. Mm-hmm. Going, you gotta see this one, which is pretty fun. One more quick fact. The manga was actually originally released in Western territories in color, computer colored by Steve Olif, making it the first ongoing comics work to use computer color in North America. And another fun fact, which is less fun, is while the color Marvel issues did finish up in their original run, republishing the single issues, the trade paperbacks that Marvel was doing with graffiti designs and the hardcovers, never finished in North America. Oh. So if you had been reading the trades or the hardcovers, you never got the end. You never got volume six. Oh. It wasn't until Dark Horse in 2000 started republishing it, this time, this edition, in the original Japanese black and white. And then the original Japanese publisher, Kodansha, entered the market in directly with Kodansha Comics, pulled the rights back from Dark Horse, put out their own edition that was just the Dark Horse edition with a different logo on the spine, and that happened in 2009. But finally, in 2017, they released a brand new edition of Akira as a hardcover box set, and this is the one you may have seen unboxings of all over the internet for a while. And this one is in its original right-to-left Japanese reading orientation, and it's also got a brand new translation, the original Japanese sound effects, some back matter. It comes in a really pretty box. I think that's the version that Deb has in her collection. And I should say, there is no official printed or digital release of the color Akira editions at this time. I know a lot of fans who are superhero fans know Akira as color comics. But if you look, you can find them. That's all I'm going to say about that. And without any further ado, Chip, what did you think of Akira?
Yeah, pretty good.
Oh?
I loved it. There are things in it that tripped me up, but I was pretty amazed at how wildly inventive it got, especially in terms of like panel layouts, because it is so long, and you know there are a fair amount of bike chases, but they managed to like kind of breathe new life into every page, and I like studying it, I don't know how they did it, because like when I'm writing comics or drawing comics, I always notice that I'm repeating myself constantly, and there's no repetition in here at all, which is stunning. I don't know if it maintains that through volumes 2 through 6, but yeah, it's pretty wild to read for the first time.
Interesting. And you obviously, David, Deb, and I had read it before. What did you guys think on this reread in this 2021, different time, different place?
David, go ahead.
So I'm at the part in rereading where it's like, oh, it's all like the little details and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And kind of building on what Chip was talking about like the sheer diversity of artwork in the book, the way Kaneda's like black leather jacket is rendered is really cool to me this time around. Because it's mostly like a black figure with maybe white out marks or vice versa. I don't draw, so I can't actually say exactly what it is. But it stands out compared to the rest of the book, which has like a very clean kind of gray feel, like with the screen tone and things like that. And it's just like such a cool way of rendering such like a tiny thing. And it even works when there's a fight scene where he's in black water wearing a black jacket, but it's still perfectly intelligible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of fascinated by the tools that were used, because every line has such life to it, because the backgrounds can sometimes feel really sterile in books like this where there's a lot of detail in it, but the line work is just like, it's so varied, but just finely varied. Like it's not a brush, it appears to be a dip pen, and then the Zipitone or Letraset for the gray is also really masterful. Yeah, like technically, obviously, it's amazing. Yeah. And one thing I really took note of was, because the backgrounds are so detailed and really realistic, and the characters kind of obviously have more of a cartoony element to them, it reminded me a lot of American animation, because that's kind of the history of animation, is spending a lot of time on your backgrounds and then keeping the character simple because you have to like redraw them over and over again. And you don't notice that kind of that difference in like the superhero comics. Like the superhero comics foreground and background characters or elements are usually kind of done in the same style. Whereas here, obviously there's a discrepancy there between the two, but it works so well because the rendering is lovely and there's still like fine details, even though the characters are quite cartoony.
I wanted to actually ask you about that. Deb, I'm going to come back to you and get your thoughts. But real quick, you said in episode zero, Chip, that you didn't gravitate to manga because it seemed cartoony. It seemed like less mature than the Vertigo books that you were reading. And while reading this again, my big experience was like, wow, he really cartoons the hell out of this book at parts. Oh, yeah. Like it is, like, especially the one that really caught me was at just at the beginning when the gym teacher is just slapping the shit out of him. And he like flips his hair back in like the super cartoony dramatic style. And it's just like, there's that character, that scene is in the movie, but it's everyone's on model in every frame of the movie. Like there's so little exaggeration that way. And this one, Kaneda's kind of rubber, especially for the first half of the volume. Like his face is constantly doing all kinds of crazy shit. It gets a little bit less so as it goes on. But did that put you off, Chip, or no?
No, because it felt like it matched the tone, because you know there's the rubbery cartooniness, but the situations are also like that too. Like, you know, even looking at the scene with the headmaster yelling at them all, like it's very, everything's very exaggerated in terms of tone and the way the characters talk to each other, which is actually something it took me a while to get used to as well. Like, I don't know if it's also a translation issue, but I found a lot of it just kind of like really jarring. So the big difference for me reading, you know, North American standard superhero kind of books in this is the balloons. When somebody's yelling, you have like, you know, the spiky balloons. But in here, it felt like if someone's voice raised slightly, they would use that.
Okay.
which kept throwing me off, because like it just always felt like a character going, well, I don't know about that. Well, I do know about that. Like it's just like really, really intense as a reading experience. But it also lends to that cartooniness of it all. Like nothing actually feels natural in the text. Everything's kind of hyper exaggerated
the whole way through, or did you think more so at the beginning and less so at the end?
Kind of the whole way through. And again, I think some of it is just translation issues. But it is all very exaggerated. Like this isn't just a straightforward sci-fi story. It's a sci-fi superhero story. Like I was just, when I was reading it, there's a scene where like the government officials are coming to the school, and Kaneda just smashes out of like a third story window.
Yeah.
To get away. At the beginning, it's pretty
fun.
That's
so good.
And it's like, okay, yeah. Well, like when that happens, you're like, okay, it's not just like, you know, close call motorbike chasing. It's like this, the whole world is really heightened here with this 15-year-old firing guns and like doing these insane stunts. And you lose yourself in it. It's, you know, I found it pretty delightful.
Yeah. So let's backtrack for just one sec. Deb, did you have any initial thoughts on rereading or anything you wanted to share? Anything that stood out to you this time through?
Well, I guess what I always find really interesting is because I haven't read this in its entirety for, I'd say, at least 10 years. I kind of know what the premise of the story, but then like Chip was saying, like the sequence of how things happen is always really surprising and delightful. Like there's this moment where Kaneda is like, he's in the sewer and then like he's falling down, but then he propels himself off the side of the sewer and like jumps across.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's these moments where the motorcycle like runs over the clown guy's face, you know?
Yeah.
And then there's always something really inventive about it. Like it's very kinetic and it's not hard to follow. You know, like with so much detail, you would think that it would be hard to follow what's going on. Like I find that happens sometimes with One Piece. I find that sometimes happens for me with Attack on Titan. Like it's so detailed, but it's hard for me to follow what's actually happening. I don't, you know, Akira has a ton of speed lines. Like you can, and it's really, it could be busy, but you can feel this energy. When we were talking about the it's all Japanese sound effects, there was this one panel here that just kind of threw me off a little bit, which was this one where he's just, what he's saying is all in Japanese.
Which page is that?
This is page 260. This is when he's like getting all the gangs together, and that's
what
just
volume
like,
though?
Volume 1.
Oh, it's different in my edition. Huh. Fascinating.
Yeah, it's not. It's about maybe 3/4 way through.
Yeah.
But it's like when he's getting the gangs all together, he's, and then the Japanese text is like really tightly, like tight letting. And then you look in the bottom and there's a translation that says, "We're not going to let a bunch of hobbling junkies kick our asses. We've got good health and bad fucking behavior. Let's show them who the real delinquents are."
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah. And it's a little weird, right? Because, you know, all the text is in English. And then all of a sudden, like when he's yelling in Japanese, he's like, yep, like they kept it with the original Japanese text.
That's interesting because it's totally different on mine. And I like yours better. I like the way that the yelling is in the background.
Yeah.
But even the translation on mine is different.
Is it?
Yes, damn it. It's a man of honor. No biker's worth a shit. Let a bunch of junkies kick their asses. And yours is like so much more what I think of Akira as being.
Yeah.
Like yours is just like, we've got, you know, bad behavior and we're like, it's just like, yeah, it's yeah, there you go.
The way that that Otomo uses Japanese text, like the sound effects and stuff like that, I appreciate that the Kodansha edition keeps all the original Japanese sound effects, but rather than subtitling what the sound effects is, you have to go to the back and then there's this whole list of what the sound effects are, which I find not helpful if you're an English reader.
Yeah.
Like, I can read hiragana and katakana, and I can see where I can see, like, you know, like the moment where, like, Tetsuo's, like, feels like this boom, you know, like this psychic headache, like this throbbing in his head. You can hear the do-dong, you know, because I can read that. But to anyone else, it looks like rectangles.
You're looking at it. Are you really going to flip to page 500 to see what those rectangles
are?
Yeah.
Exactly.
I got to say, when it comes to sound effects in manga, and Chip, we're going to run into this a lot. My edition, the Dark Horse edition, everything is completely translated in English and all the Japanese is taken out. And some of the background graffiti and stuff is even a little bit censored in my edition. But I like what Yen does, where they leave everything in and then they gloss it. Like they put the English underneath like a translation of the sound effect in the style of the sound effect, but they leave the Japanese in. It adds to the visual clutter a little bit, but I think it also I think lettering is such a big part of art, at least in manga. I don't think it is for everybody, but I think for a lot of manga, it's such a big part of the art. And we'll include graphics on the show notes or something like that. But like the example that Deb showed where like that, all that text was deleted from my edition and then replaced with word balloons. Whereas in your edition, it's part of the art. It's supposed to be like one really solid, beautiful piece of artwork. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like this kind of stuff, right? Where it's the motorcycle is going. It's just a do 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 do. You know, but it doesn't tell you anywhere if you're not if you can't read Japanese. So the only reason why I started to realize this, how uncomfortable this could feel, was when I read Korean manhwa.
Oh, okay.
And then there would be not a translation of the sound effects. And I'd be like, what is that? You know? Like, what was it? I've been reading Uma's Table.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which is Korean. And there's a degree of that. And you're like, oh, that's what it feels like to read this and not read Japanese.
Actually, so yeah, Chip, did that bother you that you have the new edition, the Kodansha edition, I assume.
Yeah.
Yeah, did that bother you that the sound effects, are your sound effects in Japanese or are they in English? Is it just the Dark Horse one with the Kodansha logo or is it the new edition?
I mean, they're in English.
Oh, okay.
I think the paperback version is the Dark Horse as paperback. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. I thought that they had done a new printing of the paperbacks, which took the hardcover guts out, but no, eh? Okay.
No. They've been steadily reprinting new runs of the Akira box set, but they haven't re-released it as fresh paperbacks. I think possibly because what's coming up in the next year or so is Otomo is editing all of his work and re-releasing it.
I think that'll be like, I can't wait for it.
Yeah,
but I wonder which editions they'll release.
Stuff that's never made it in English and if it came in English, it's completely out of print in English. So he's he's doing this complete end-to-end re-editing of his entire output. So my guess is that they're holding out on that. Just like that's why there's no digital one.
Very exciting. This is interesting. I think that would have been a barrier, but I think some of the other manga that we'll end up suggesting to Chip at some point will have those Japanese effects. We'll come back to that and ask him how he feels about that in the book. So if anyone from Kodansha is listening to this podcast, I am apparently, and Chip apparently are the only ones without the new box set versions of Akira. If you would like to comp us copies of the Akira box set, we would gratefully accept them. Well, I don't know about Chip's being grateful, but I would be grateful to accept it, but that's okay.
I'd be somewhat grateful.
Yeah, somewhat grateful. There we go. You know what? Thinking about this is like there's so much weird stuff about Akira, the manga, I kind of want to get into, but the first thing I want to ask Chip is, did you notice that there's no chapter breaks? Did you notice that this is like effectively a graphic novel that just like goes and it's just scene after scene after scene after scene after scene?
I did notice, and I have a lot of questions about that.
Okay, we've got answers.
I mean, I learned in your intro that it was serialized.
Yeah.
But how?
Oh, you don't see where the cutoff is.
No, I can't. Yeah, like it's all clearly just one story, and I'm just like, well, where were they cutting scenes? Did they change page lengths?
I never thought of that.
For each installment, or?
The last page of the first chapter, the very first chapter, is page 31, which is, when the police get here, tell them how it happened. But aren't you the police? That's actually the last page of the first chapter, of the very first chapter of Akira, the first serialization.
That makes sense, right? Because it cuts to the school on the next page.
Yeah, and that's sort of where it ends. Like, but aren't you
that
the police?
That doesn't line up with my numbers, I should say, too.
Oh, okay. Like,
these are all very different versions, I guess. You,
I love it. I love that we've all got completely different versions of this book.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how you know it's a classic. None of the volumes line up. The main volumes line up. The page numbers don't. But yeah, so it was serialized in Young Magazine, and every chapter had a title page that he drew that is not included in this edition. It's actually only ever published in the Akira Club hardcover book that's in the box set. There's a section that has all the chapter pages.
Oh.
And so there would always be a standalone illustration to break up, to introduce the manga when it started. Mm-hmm. But he really conceived of this as you literally start at page one of volume one and read through to the last page of volume six, as scenes shifting. And when he wants there to be a pause or wants you as a reader to take a moment, he'll do that in the text. So there'll be things like a double page spread of the crater where you're supposed to sort of like, whoa, and take a breath at the very beginning. And that continues like when the colonel gets to the underground base, the big sort of chilled cooler round thing with the tubes coming out of it. That's like where Akira is. Like that also, for example, is supposed to be like your pause, your break, your whatever. But yeah, there are absolutely invisible chapter cuts in here because he would just start the next scene. And every once in a while, I could kind of tell when we were starting maybe a new chapter because there was like a good cliffhangery, like or pseudo cliffhanger at the end of a scene. And then we go in and we start a new scene somewhere else. But sometimes I went and checked. Sometimes these scenes break in media res, like you like break in the middle of a scene and then start in the middle of the scene, the same scene in the next chapter. Mm. And it's just like, how do you keep an idiot in suspense? You know, and it's like, I'll tell you next month.
So this leads to my next question, which is, did everyone know how long this was going to go from the beginning? Like, was it plotted out that way?
Probably not. No,
because my comparison is I do work for Image Comics, and we all strive to create like a full time ongoing series, but we also recognize that sales may mean we'd have to wrap it up after 12 issues or 20 issues, whatever. So I'm just wondering if the success of this meant that he felt forced to go as long as he did, or if that was always the plan.
Mm.
That's an interesting one because the anime came out before the manga ended. And so that's why the anime has kind of a weird truncatedness to it, and the ending is different.
So I read an interview with him today, and with the creator, with Otomo Sensei, and he's like, I planned Akira to be one volume, but literally as soon as I started working on it and introducing these characters, I just kept creating more problems for myself from a storytelling point of view, where they had stories that needed to be told that fed into the overall thing. I think I'm going to say, if anything, it ended maybe earlier than he intended at a certain point, with six volumes. He said he wrote it, he said he wrote it as like, this is a one volume thing, but he knew by like, I don't know, a couple chapters in that it was going to be much longer than that, because he just kept introducing characters who had backstories and arcs that needed to get told. And then the first volume came out, and the first volume sold 300,000 copies on a 3,000 copy, I think, original print run or something like that. So it was just like, oh, I can do whatever the fuck I want. Like, I can just literally do whatever I want, and here we go. So I actually feel like, especially at the end in volume six, some of the chapters that were serialized were like 12 pages. He couldn't even hit 20 pages because he was so busy with so much other stuff going on, or like, you know, he didn't want to use assistants or whatever, whatever. So I think that like, he probably wrapped it up just sort of like Miyazaki. Well, if we ever talk about Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, the manga by Hayao Miyazaki, he just, it ends. It doesn't complete. It just ends.
Just stops.
And I kind of feel like Akira has a much more natural ending, but I feel like if he had been still firing all cylinders like he was a couple volumes earlier, like if he hadn't had to stop to work on the anime and stuff, Akira could have gone on for longer for sure. Like there's still stories there to be told, I think, but I could be wrong.
I would guess that he had a plan, because there's stuff in the first volume, like actually the first half of the first volume, that comes back into play like three or four volumes down the line.
Wow.
So he at least knew where he wanted to go at the very least.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't, you know, guaranteed.
Well, I've got another question. These are all just like, I don't know, technical questions. I don't understand a lot of things. So in the version I have, the first several pages are color paintings.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that how it originally started?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of manga will get, especially on their first chapter, color pages to basically be like, hey, look at this. This is new and exciting. Mm-hmm. Kind of a thing.
It's so weird to me because as I opened a book and I started to read those pages, I'm like, these are bad paintings. Like, they're just straight up not good paintings. Mm-hmm. Like the two-page spread of the explosion and the buildings. Like, if that was drawn by him, it would have had so much more resonance, so much more feeling. But it's just clunky brushstrokes and doesn't make use of his, you know, knowledge of perspective and tone. Like, I was surprised, actually. And then when those color pages end and you get that first page, the black and white page of the freeway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the city
in the
distance.
It's one of the most gorgeous things I've seen in a comic ever. Mm-hmm. And there's not a lot to it. Like, it's just such a well-composed, ominous page that it blows everything before it out of the water. I'm surprised that was part of it, like the painted colored original pages, because everything that follows is so much better.
I wish we had the color versions to show you that Marvel, Steve Olaf and
Olaf,
they did for Epic back in the day. Like, Olaf's colors kind of follow these paintings as a guide a little bit, kind of a similar mood, similar tone. But because it's over his art, it looks a lot better, I think.
Yeah. There was a thing with the guy who did the colors. Is that he worked closely with Otomo, and Otomo colored some of the pages and gave him a sense of how he wanted the color tones to be. And then he used that as a starting point. So whenever Felix Comic Art sells some of these pages, he'll sometimes say, this is an Otomo colored page.
Yeah. Ooh, I bet those are a little bit more money.
Those are a little more
money. Yeah, no kidding. I don't have an association with Japanese comics and color. Mm-hmm. Like, it just never comes to my mind when I think of
it's,
comics.
It's largely practical, you know, because it's a lot cheaper to print on, like, you know, when these magazines are serialized, they're printed on fairly cheap newsprint. Mm-hmm. And to print color like you do in American comics, is very expensive to print, and it's very heavy. So, like, there's if you ever read, there's a manga about a guy who works in a bookstore called Skull-Faced Bookseller of Honda-san. And Honda-san is a book buyer, and he's responsible for the American comics section. And so whereas all the other booksellers can you carry a stack of manga and go restack their shelves, he has the American stuff, and he's like, oh, god damn, this stuff is heavy.
It's such an inside, like, this person works in publishing joke in the comic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love that. I love that so much. Skull-Faced Bookseller Honda-san is awesome.
It's so funny because now we, and I've tried this a couple of times, when you put in a quote trying to get like a North American comic printed on newsprint because you like the feel of it or whatever, it costs more.
Ron Wimber they did, right? With his zine.
If I decide to do a black and white newsprint comic, it would cost me more than a thicker paper full color comic.
Backwards. Like in Hip Hop Family Tree, what I really appreciated is that when he's telling the story of the comics artists, the rap artists from the 70s, it's all colored and looks like newsprint. And then when he shows the artist in today reminiscing, then it's all they put a white back color to make it pop and look like modern day. So he really plays with this newsprint color and stuff like that. But what I like a lot about Japanese manga being black and white, and particularly with someone like Otomo who has beautiful line work and tone, is that it's so crisp and nice and he's in control of the color and of the density and, like, you know, what to come forward, what comes forward, what goes in the background. Whereas sometimes what I find hard about American comics is sometimes if you have a bad color, it just becomes this big muddy mess.
Oh god, yeah. No, I know. It's I'm a pain in the ass to work with on most comics. And I think colorists probably hate me even more than the line artists because the speed at which comics are made, some colorists are just like basically slapping down color and, you know, they enjoy the rendering more than they enjoy the color choice. Because that's a huge thing with North American comics is the rendering, right? Mm-hmm. It's the same problem that you have with the line art too. There are certain comic artists who just want to, you know, do cross hatching on Batman's muscles, but they're not thinking of anything beyond that. And color artists have the same problem. They just want to like render a face and like the cheekbones and everything, but they're not actually choosing color. Mm-hmm. I was dealing with a colorist this morning where they're having difficulty. They're doing flat colors and they're having difficulty with the color choices. And I sent them an article about Matt Hollingsworth on Hawkeye.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think it was the New York Post did this piece on him about like this, the amazing color work he does. And they showed his flats, like the colors without the ink and the colors without the ink. You could still, it was all unified. You could still tell, you know, what the story was, and you could tell what parts were supposed to pop out. Mm. Just really beautifully done. And, you know, I could picture that kind of work over this because this is so detailed. Like, I'd be very curious to see what the color version is because in my mind, it's very flat color where you just make certain elements pop.
The color is really good, but it suffers from the fact that it wasn't intended to be colored. They didn't take any of the screen tone out. It creates a really interesting look that I think is especially now like dates to a very specific time in a cool way. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like it's like the comic book equivalent of 8-bit graphics, you know what I mean? Or 16-bit graphics. Like at the time it's like, oh, we keep getting nicer and nicer graphics. But now that look has its own weight, has its own importance, has its own resonances. So yeah, if you get a chance, there are some like example scans on the internet that you can maybe take a look at. I would recommend that. But yeah, actually on that note, since we were talking about story structure a little bit, did it change anything for you when you started reading this volume, knowing that it's only 6 volumes, that it actually has an ending to it? Is it less intimidating that way? Because you're talking about like, did it always intend to be 6 volumes or whatever? And it you know, let's say he's never said anything to the contrary other than I screwed up in the planning stages, but then by volume 1, like I knew it was going to go a certain length. Was it less intimidating for you to know that it had an ending?
The only thing I found intimidating was my wallet.
Okay.
Like knowing it's 6 volumes, and I don't know, when I buy a novel, which is a complete story, you know, at most I'm spending, you know, $20 probably on it. And with this, it's like, okay, if I want the full story, like what was this? This was like 30
Canadian.
Yeah, 30 Canadian. So, you know, I'm pushing like $200 there to get the full story.
Yeah.
which, you know, I mean, I'm not necessarily hurting for money, but I'm not doing that well. So to get the rest, I found that part a little intimidating, because like when I hit the end, I did want to find out what happens next.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I will end up buying the next volume and all the way through to volume 6, because why stop at 2, right?
Yeah.
So that's the only part I really found intimidating. I'm fascinated that somebody can spend that much time on a thing and devote that many pages to a story. Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to see if it changes, because that's the other thing. Like when you're reading a novel, it's not like as you get closer to the end of the novel, the writer gets better. Right? Like maybe it does, and like I just can't see it, but you know, if you're reading a novel, there's a consistency to it. Mm-hmm. And I find with comic books and graphic novels, like if there's a long run, there's a change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And it's obvious, because it's in the art and not the writing. Mm-hmm. So that part I'm really interested in, to see what the difference is going to be between volume 1 and volume 6. And if there's a consistency to it.
I don't know, man. I'm looking at volume 6 right here. It looks like Akira still.
I felt like, you know, like his drawing evolved before. Like his,
yeah.
Like in the, because I have some of the Japanese short story ones, like Highway Star and the one with the big whale, Sayonara Nippon.
Project to project is different, though.
Was the, and you see that a little bit in volume 1, is there's some real jokey moments. Like the time when like the girl sets the bomb off in the sewer, and he's like, "Yay, I got him!" And he's like, and she, because she had covered her ears, but he says, "Could you give me some warning next time?" And then there's several chapters after that where he can't hear, and then he's going, "Huh, huh."
I think that the tone does change. Like it's still a little bit goofy, but
oh yeah, I think that. With a long-running comic like this, in addition to the craft changing, there's an element of, I think, that artists figure out what they like to draw. Mm-hmm. Over like 8 years doing the same book, so they kind of lean into that skid a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think in that sense, there's definitely an evolution in Otomo's art and what he chooses to draw and how he chooses to depict it. The way he draws cities, I think, changes a little bit.
Oh, really? How so?
Well, there's a big spoiler thing that happens halfway through this story.
Okay.
That requires one thing, but mostly it's in the detail.
Yeah.
Like in terms of like a lot of the character in volume 1 comes from how old and decrepit the buildings look. Mm-hmm. Like they've been there for a while. There's tons of trash. Mm. It's just sort of almost like him showing off with his line. And the deeper in this series you get, I think the more you notice that, like, oh, he's really good at drawing craters. He's really good at drawing characters in perspective. To kind of emphasize, like, the setting, I suppose.
Well, I'm looking forward to spending $200 to find that out.
Yeah, it's great. Totally worth it. Chris, I know you asked Chip what he thought was the most pretty good, but what did you think was the most pretty good this time around?
Oh, right. Okay. I was actually going to jump in on this earlier, but I wanted to hear everybody else's thoughts. But my biggest one was the anime has completely... I know I've read Akira before, but reading this, I couldn't help but compare it to the anime the whole time. I could, like, especially at the beginning, like the bikes, I could hear the, like, the heavy breathing from the soundtrack and the, like, crackle of thunder. And the soundtrack is so, so, so iconic now. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't help but hear it at key points when I was reading. Anytime anything happened, I was mentally comparing it to the anime. And it was like, not in like this was worse or this was better, but it was like, oh, it's not, like, it's different. And I was just very aware of it. And that was surprising how heavily the anime had imprinted its version of the story on me, even though it is very different. It's very different. That's the other thing. It's like Tetsuo goes back and forth to the army in some capacity, the army hospital, 3 times in this volume. Like, it ends with him going to like agree to go back with the colonel to the army hospital again, right? Mm-hmm. In the movie, that's one thing. He gets captured one time.
Oh, really?
And then that's it. The movie is just so
compressed.
It's compact, and it's like when I was done, I was like, did Otomo fix his early work with the anime? Did he go back and look at it and go, yeah, that's weird that he gets taken to the military hospital, then comes back to school, then goes to the military hospital again, then escapes and goes back to like and joins the bikers, and then goes back to the military hospital again. Like, was that a mistake that he decided was in the story, or that was important in my story, but I'm going to tell it a different way because of the different medium? And that was the thing that was curious to me.
I imagine budget had a lot to do with that.
Yeah.
Because asking someone to draw 3 military hospital escape scenes in a comic is one thing.
Yeah.
But then drawing, 140,000 frames of it for an animation is a little bit different.
I will say the repetition of him like kind of going in and out of the hospital reminds me of the kind of the one actual story issue I have with this volume, which is... I don't have a sense of Kaneda and Tetsuo as friends. When by the end, they basically are enemies. I don't have a sense of their friendship in the beginning because there's not a lot of time spent on it because the incident happens so quickly where Tetsuo is taken away and just kind of comes back and disappears and comes back that you don't really have as strong a connection as to... kind of the brother turning on brother elements.
Yeah. That is a lot clearer in the movie, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's more clear in the movie because they added the flashback where they're like, hey, we were friends as kids. Check us out. Yeah. We're cute.
Yeah. I mean, that shows up later in the manga too. But I think you're right. It's like, I can forgive it a little bit because I know, I know that aspect is told later on. And so when you come to it fresh and you've not seen it before, it's like, oh, yeah, what's the deal with these two,
Yeah, though I will say that my favorite scene in the book, also from a technical standpoint, is the death of Yamagata.
Mm. Isn't that good?
Which is so masterfully done. Just like the framing of characters, the pace of it, the POV... the rendering, like everything about it is told for maximum emotional impact. Mm-hmm. Even though I don't really have much of a sense of Yamagata in the story, you feel that death on a level that I don't think you could pull off necessarily in the anime.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's done completely different in the anime as well.
Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
It's actually really amazing because I think Kaoru Mori does this too, where just the facial expressions can tell you a lot about the personality of the character without really having to explain too much. In volume one, you see Tetsuo's personality change a lot. Yeah. And it's all told through it's largely told through his facial expressions and body language.
Oh man, him riding the bike.
Oh, like
without
that.
Hands.
That panel is boss.
It's one of the coolest shots I've ever seen. It's so good.
There's a scene in, I think, volume 2 or volume 3 that's like my favorite. This is a close second. With Tetsuo in like a fur-trimmed jacket. It is just
On the elevator?
On the elevator that is like... Oh my God, he's the coolest person that ever lived. And he's like, not. He's like a huge nerd with a giant forehead, but it's so fucking funny. It's so good.
Have you ever seen Barkira?
I have seen Barkira. Yeah.
Have you heard of this shit?
No.
It's a fanzine where people took the story of Akira and they replaced them all with Simpsons characters.
Oh, Barkira. Okay, yeah. All right.
It's I gotta say, it's the most involved collaborative art project involved. I've ever seen.
I gotta say,
it's,
like,
it's crazy.
I'm trying to picture, like, Tetsuo with, like, a fur-lined jacket just looks like one of the Gallagher brothers or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Not too far off.
am I close?
You're actually pretty close. That whole scene has, like, well, and that's the other quote that Otomo, that really resonated when I was reading this, that Otomo said, it's like, it's rock and roll. Like, the whole thing is, like, young kids and punks and rock and roll and drugs and whatever. It's just, like, fucking cranked up to 11 and everything's just, like, going nonstop. And he wanted to tell a story for the youth. And he wasn't that old. Well, you know, I say that as someone who's, you know, much older than he was when he started Akira, but he wasn't old when he started Akira. Like, he was a lot closer to Kaneda's age than he is to his own age today when he started it. And I think that that's a big part of the story, is that, like, yeah, you should. It's so interesting too, because the movie is like, the soundtrack to the movie is the antithesis of rock and roll. It is atmospheric and so different. But yeah, like, there are parts where, like, Kaneda should rock up and, like, that crunchy fucking T-Rex guitar riff from 20th Century Boys should kick in.
Yeah,
and you're like, yeah. I feel like that's why 20th Century Boys as a manga exists by Urasawa. It's just so that he could, like, make that T-Rex reference that fucking Otomo, he was clearly inspired by, did not do in Akira. Oh, speaking of inspiration, the other thing I thought that was really, really big for me is I learned, in between the last time I read Akira and now, how important Akira was to Taiyo Matsumoto, who's my favorite manga artist.
Oh, do tell.
Who did Ping Pong and Tech on Kinkreet, Black and White, and Sunny, which is the sad one, and lots of other stuff. I just rewatched the Ping Pong movie for a thing I'm working on, and the scene there, the flashback scene with Pecco and Smile, the two kids from Ping Pong, is so like the flashback scene between Tetsuo and Kaneda when they're both kids on the school ground, with Kaneda stepping in after Tetsuo has been bullied. The same thing sort of happens in Ping Pong. And Matsumoto's not shy about talking about how Akira and Otomo's work was the greatest inspiration on his own work, although you can't see it in his artwork. And he actually did. There's a really good poster. We'll put it up in the show notes, of like a kid just with his eyes peeking over the edge of Akira, intensely staring at a volume of Akira, as a poster he did, I think, for Angoulême. It's awesome. Yeah, so much of the Kaneda-Tetsuo relationship informs, I think, a lot of the different friendship relationships between two dudes in Matsumoto's early work, like Tekkon, like Ping Pong, like Go-Go Monster, like, I'm looking at my shelf, all the mangas. And even then, Blue Spring, which was his first short story collection, is just full of, like, badass teenager fuck-ups doing crazy shit at this school that's scheduled for demolition, so everyone has given up on the students and the school and whatever. Anyway, so Matsumoto, hugely inspired by Akira, and I had never seen it until this reread, and I was just like, oh yeah, okay, I could see that. Anyway, that was the other thing that stuck out to me.
That's one thing that kind of gets lost in, not lost in translation, but lost in the sands of time since this book came out, is that Kaneda and Tetsuo and all the crew are like biker gangs, which were like a real problem in 82 in Japan. So it's sort of like if this was about Marvel Tufts in New York in the 70s, it's like the same kinds of characters.
Yeah.
So there's probably some shorthand characterization wise that we're missing.
Well, like the Warriors movie, right? Where all the different
same
gangs
thing.
had a shtick. And so, like, they have the clown gang, right? Very similar.
And the capsules.
Yeah. But there's,
like,
even like
doing
this,
speed.
Like, I didn't
like,
notice
it's
it
not,
the first time.
Oh, yeah.
It's like how they get all those pills is through the nurse.
I love the nurse.
Yeah.
That's actually, if I had to choose one small thing about Akira that I like the most.
Yeah.
I think the scene with Kaneda and the nurse early on says a lot about who he is when he starts, like when he becomes like the protagonist of the book.
He's not a good guy. But then also when he like kind of forces himself on Kay when they're hiding out in the bar, and you're like, what the fuck? Like, this is not like, he's the protagonist at this point. And it's like, oh, it's revealed that he was actually like stealing something from her, which is like, all right, like that pulled that one out of the fire at the last second. But yeah, no, he's a real piece of shit. And they soften him so much in the movie.
Oh, do they?
Are there different translations for the scene with him and the nurse? Because
What it says.
Because in this one, when she tells him that she thinks she's pregnant, he says, "Hey, great, can I watch you have it?"
Yes, he says that.
That's straight through in all of them? Because that was like the most shocking line I think I've read in a comic book in a long time. For the main character to be like so dismissive and gross. And like, but then you're also like, well, he's also 15. Like they state his age in it. I'm like, I guess that's a 15-year-old. But then he runs around shooting at people. So I'm like, well.
Guns, and the fact that he has a gun, that's another cultural thing I think that David was talking about.
Yeah.
That is so shocking.
Yes.
That would have been so shocking at 82 because there's no guns in Japan. And the fact that the resistance got their hand on a gun and then a 15-year-old boy got his hand on a gun, like that, that there are manga that are just about what happens when a kid gets a gun and it's like 9 volumes in Japan. That's just like a subplot in Akira Volume 1.
There's this scene in the corner, right, where he kisses her and then when they stop locking lips, there's a little sound effect goes pop.
I love like, the sound effects.
But then you know she has like this expression she has on her face like, oh yeah, he's great, you know, but then he's still the shit to her. So I guess like when Stan Lee did a team up with the guy who did Shaman King, there was that thing where he would write the story and then Hiroyuki Take did the art. And I remember what was so jarring about that was that it made me realize that the American style of writing comics had these captions.
Mm.
These, and then there's something happened and meanwhile, blah, blah, blah. Whereas none of that happens in this story. And other than that, like, this is Tokyo and at this time and like all these cities blew up and that's it.
Captions in North American comics are a shortcut if you don't have the room and the space really to get across what's happening, where you are, what's come before, what someone's thinking, and clearly based on the pacing and the size of this, it's not needed at all. Like I can't picture where you would actually put a caption if you were to be like, yeah, this thing needs captions. Like,
can you even imagine Kaneda having an unexpressed thought though?
I know.
I think the cover for that, they do a thing that 24, the TV show 24 does a lot where everyone always says what they're doing or where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I've got to get through the sewer to the upper level to do blah, blah, blah. And like it's written in character, so it doesn't feel like exposition.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like someone psyching themselves up or something like that.
I will say
go ahead. I was just going to say every Stan Lee, Jack Kirby comic, like I would have been furious if I was Kirby for a bunch of reasons. but like Stan Lee would just have characters say what they're doing as they're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're totally unnecessary just to put a stamp on a thing. Like I need to jump over this wall to get to the other side, and it's somebody jumping over the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like, yeah. I mean,
that's what I one thing I like about Japanese manga.
Manga's so much better.
A lot of it's the artist is the writer. So
yeah,
you know, don't just tell me, show me. You know, and they're in control of that.
I mean, how often? Like, what's the split with manga in terms of? How many series are done with a separate writer and artist, and how many are done with like a single cartoonist?
I want to say 80-20. Like
previously, it was mostly cartoonists.
Yeah. But
there have been a few hit series lately that kind of have both writer and artist. But like the classics, you know, Rumiko Takahashi, Akira Toriyama.
Yeah.
Most of the big names are cartoonists.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Most of the work I find myself gravitating towards are cartoonists as well, now that I think about it.
It's even stuff like all the sound effects being in perspective in the different panels.
I gotta see that. I gotta see that edition because mine's all in English.
I love the original Japanese sound effect because it's part of the like this scene where like they're like where the motorcycles are like exploding and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's a full on, you know. Part of the composition.
Mine, So my the sound effects, instead of doing the do 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 like they have there, it's B R O O B R O B R, and they use that so much. So it's brew bro brew bro brew bro brew bro brew bro, which I think is hilarious.
That's the French version. I forget what the American one is.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, maybe brew bro brew bro brew bro. I remember like that. I remember hearing like this American Life thing about Harley Davidson. And that the sound of a Harley Davidson is copyrighted, like trademarked, because it's supposed to sound like James Colburn saying potato over and over again.
Oh, of course.
Potato, yeah. potato.
But kind of going back to Chip's point earlier about how so much of it is cartoonier than he, well, a mix of cartoony and realistic. Mm. Occasionally he'll just draw one character in like extreme realism. For effect.
Mm. Like, do you have a page that you're looking at?
There's one of Tetsuo.
That badass Tetsuo drawing where he's driving the bike without his hands.
Oh, yeah.
There's that one. There's one where, like, he's leaning his head back and, like, looking at the sky a little bit before that. Mm. I'm flipping through now, but not fast enough, clearly. But it sort of adds to that feeling of the book where the definition of what's real is pretty wide. Like, what Otomo can get away with.
Yeah,
and
that makes sense.
It's just such a cool feel, even in the car chases. Like, there's a bit where Kaneda steals a truck, and as he's stealing it, like, there are all these like soldiers hanging off of it. Mm-hmm. He's running over like two dudes, but it's like a cartoony Bugs Bunny kind of way.
Yeah,
and it's not realistic at all, but it's drawn in a realistic way. Mm-hmm. So you just kind of buy in, I feel.
There's one bit of realism that I found quite jarring, which was the newspaper article.
Oh, yeah.
Where so it's a photo of a woman. And I'm like, why would you do that?
It's a joke. That photo is the photo that's on it's one of the cover models from Young Magazine. Young Magazine, the serialization, would have photo covers of like idols of like Japanese girl, like pretty Japanese girls. So that like magazine cover is an in-joke from the serialization, because it was one of the characters that was one of the ladies that was on the cover of the magazine. Because at the end of the day, this dude was like in his 20s and like, you know, making a funny manga. So yeah, I hear you. I was really so thrown out by that at first as well.
Wait, which page is this? I want to see.
It is 109, 110 maybe in your edition, 108 somewhere in there.
It's minus 113.
Japan Times, a week after 18th District disaster, canal repairs still delayed. And yeah, it's like absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
It's absolutely the Young Magazine cover lady. Probably for that chapter. Maybe even for that issue, but maybe the one before it.
That's very funny.
How funny.
Speaking of, since I have, since we're doing quick differences, I wanted to say he went back in the tankobons that we've got here and made significant changes to the artwork throughout. It's one of the things that we're seeing this 30 years removed from serialization, 30 to 40 almost years removed from the serialization when it started. And so he would actually redraw panels and sometimes rearrange or redraw whole pages between his serialization and his manga. And there's actually a really good website that's got a couple of pages that show the differences between. And I actually found another one. It's funny, Chip, that you mentioned that the explosion, the painted explosion that starts off the book, didn't look up to your to snuff for you, and I actually agree, it's not up to the same level as his line art. That's a redo that was done for the first volume. He actually someone found a copy of the first serialized volume of or not volume but chapter of Akira and Young Magazine from December 1982 and put all the pages up, and the original double page spread there is so much worse, like shockingly bad, that you can't believe that it's from the same manga, but all the other art is the same. It's just been cut and spliced and rearranged on the page and stuff. And it's like, yeah, it's not what it should be considering how good the line art is. But yeah, the double page spread is brutal.
Really?
Brutal.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
So you mentioned Young Magazine, and that reminds me of one thing we haven't talked about yet, which is that manga in Japan is often organized by target audience rather than, like, there's no one piece like go out and buy One Piece issue number one, you have to buy Shonen Jump. And Young Magazine was targeted at adult men, I think. Is that right, Chris? Mm-hmm.
It's a seinen manga, so it was, and it was at the upper end of seinen, which is like older teen, young adults, like, or young people in their 20s. Mm-hmm. But a lot of salarymen would read it as well. So yeah, absolutely that age group. And yeah, it would have like photographs of sexy girls, sometimes, usually, especially as the magazine went on, in bikinis and things like that, as things got more permissible into the 90s.
So it was like really just...
Yeah, it was like, it's like if Maxim or something also had like 250 pages of comics an issue. along with like pickup articles and, you know, cute girls. And they're just like photo spreads. I actually bought Young Magazine, I think in 94 or 95, because I heard that that's where Akira was and I thought it was a good start. So there was like a Japanese grocery near me. And I started picking up issues of Young Magazine, and I can't remember any of the manga, honestly, that was in it at the time, but it was just cool to get Japanese manga. I switched over to Shonen Jump because it was cheaper after a while, and that I remember. It was the Shaman, it was the Shaman King author's story before he did Shaman King, maybe, or no, it was the Yu-Gi-Oh had just started serialization, so I had the Shonen Jump issues where Yugi was still doing like weird challenges every issue before it turned into just trading cards 100% of the time. DBZ, I think, was either just finishing or had just finished serialization and they were waiting for the next big hit. But it's an interesting thing that Akira was so firmly aimed at like people in their older teens and young 20-year-olds.
For me, like Akira coincided with rave culture. In like the late 80s, early 90s. So that's why, like, you know, the pill taking and the biker gangs and stuff like that. Like, sometimes I would go to like these warehouse clubs and they'd be showing Akira on the screen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense.
There was an entire music video where Kanye West cosplayed Tetsuo.
No way.
Featuring Daft Punk. It's
wow.
It's a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. Yeah, it's Stronger by Kanye West. Look it up. It's the anime. It's not the manga, but that's okay. We will forgive it. It's actually really good. He did a great job cosplaying Tetsuo, I thought. Anyway,
Spike brought up something that she thought that with one difference between the anime and the manga is in the manga, the female characters are a lot stronger and more dynamic. And she felt like in the anime, a lot of them were either kind of downplayed or kind of written out, or like their interestingness was kind of the edges were sanded down, in her opinion.
See, I know that's true, but having just reread volume one, you don't really see a lot of that in this volume. And I think that's kind of interesting. Like, Kay is a good character. And I think even the nurse, like, gets a good line and is like a kind of a realized character, but you don't really get, like, you don't get the bodyguard lady. You don't get the psychic lady. You don't even get any of the kids really. Like, you just get Masaharu. And I think Chip, you're pretty well known for working on lady friendly comics. What did you think about that? Did you like, other than Kaneda being a total piece of shit?
It felt very of its time in a lot of ways. And that was definitely an instance to just have this like singular female character in this like sea of boys and men. My assumption is that as the volumes go on, that changes somewhat. But yeah, I mean, that's, again, there are definitely points reading this. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. This is the 80s. Oh yeah. Okay. This is the 80s. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, you just have to kind of excuse those things through the lens of time. But, yeah. Yeah. She's not very defined in this. Like, I kind of want to know what her deal is. But hey, there's five more volumes for me to find out.
Yeah, 1,500 pages to go.
Exactly.
So we're coming up on about an hour of recording time, and we still have another segment. We have an exciting new segment this week. So before we do that, though, I wanted to get any final thoughts Maybe we'll start with Deb, David, myself, and then we'll let Chip have the last word.
Sure.
Deb, did you have any final thoughts on Akira Volume 1?
Oh, I just love rediscovering it. I mean, this was one of the first manga that really got me really into the medium. I had always read manga, like shoujo manga and shonen manga, like stuff that's a little bit for younger audiences. This was, I think, the first manga that I read that was, other than Lone Wolf and Cub, that was definitely for adults. And the art of, I read it at the time when I was making comics myself. So I can really appreciate the level of artistry that's in this. The draftsmanship, as I'm older and I understand, I can see the way the pacing of the story goes, how inventive a lot of the action scenes are. I appreciate it now even more. I want to read the rest of it. I mean, I sat down this afternoon and plowed through it in an hour. It's great. I would recommend it to anyone as one of the high watermarks of manga.
I definitely want to read the rest of it too. David, what'd you think?
I, like I said on episode zero, like I'm completely in the bag for the series. I feel like the two key points to understanding my taste is that I discovered Todd McFarlane's Spider-Man and Akira really early. And like, if you take those two as like my fantastic, like Lee Kirby Fantastic Four, a lot of things make more sense. But like, I'm just always rereading this book because it's always teaching me how to read comics better. Like there are so many different things that he does, techniques that he uses, even just like the way he deploys screen tone or sound effects or camera angles. There's always something in there where I'm like, man, this is like the coolest thing in the world. So rereading, it's always a pleasure.
I gotta say, I agree. I really enjoyed rereading this. I couldn't get away on this read, and I think it's going to change as I move through and read the rest of the volumes, just how different it was like from the animated version. The biggest change was how the cartooning is so good in this. He's so good. He's so expressive and emotive, and he can really like doing the things like suddenly getting more detailed and more realistic with his drawing, and then suddenly going more cartoony is not something that everyone can pull off. Like they just don't have the technical chops to pull that off, and doing it in ways that enhance rather than detract from the story. For me, that was huge. Animation, especially at the time, like Akira is really lauded as an anime for being like mature and sophisticated and complex, if not complicated. And the characters are almost always on model. You know what I mean? In the Akira anime, whereas here there's so much more squash and stretch, and he's not afraid to draw in an emotional way. And for me, discovering what good comics these are, not just a good story, not just a story that I'm kind of hooked on and was a big deal, but like how good these are as comics, that was the big takeaway from Volume 1 is, if you like comics for what they are, Akira is such a good book to read and to understand, you know, what good comics are, to help understand what good comics are. Which brings us to our guinea pig, our test subject, our number 42. Chip?
I got that one.
What'd you think of Akira?
It both makes me want to draw more and to never draw again. that's the big takeaway. I'm fascinated by David saying, you know, his entryway, what he loved was McFarlane, Spider-Man, and Akira. Because they're two very cool comics, but as time goes on, you recognize that one is technically in a different place.
Yeah. They both have lots of lines, but then diverge.
it's amazing that this is both. Like, this is, like, technically unbelievable and also really cool. Because a lot of times really cool, when you look back on it, you're like, yeah, that music wasn't really good.
Yeah. Like, I'm glad I was 13 when this song came out.
Yeah. But with this, like, you know, with my, you know, fresh eyes, like, I don't have a nostalgia for this at all. Like, it's gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. And I'm definitely going to read the rest of it.
I think the road will rise to meet us on the story front as well. I think that there's a lot in this first volume that is a product of its time, that is the story finding its feet, like the fact that they go to the sewers three times, he goes to the military hospital three times, and he keeps, you know, unlike, I don't think that happens again. I think starting at volume two especially, it becomes a very different, becomes a very different series. But that's, I'm glad you all enjoyed it. I'm glad that my pick made sense for a good first volume for everybody here. And I just actually remembered, I was thinking about the first time I read the Akira comics, and I actually bought Akira 38, which was the last issue of the Marvel series, off the newsstands when it was new. And so my first Akira was the very last chapter of Akira. And I'd seen the movie, obviously, by that point, and I was like, who the hell are all these people that aren't in the fucking anime? So... I spoiled it for myself, obviously, but luckily I was only like 15 or something, so it was okay. I didn't remember it by the time I got around to reading it. Anyway, yeah, thanks so much for indulging me on this first choice for this first manga splaining. After the break, we will come back and talk about episode 2. And we're back. So here's our... sort of adjusted next segment, first next segment of the show. It's called What's the Next Book That We're Going to Make Chip Read? And normally, Deb, David, and myself would each suggest a book. We would describe the book, why we think it would be good for someone of Chip's stature and history and lifestyle to all read.
All right.
Predilections. And then he would pick it, except we actually want to get ahead. David had a very good idea. That was, why don't we not fly by the seat of our pants and have to do this every single week where we have to like track down and read a book in between weeks of the podcast. So we're going to go a couple months or a couple volumes ahead. So for this first one, Chip's not going to get to pick. Chip's just going to have to take our suggestions for what the next book is. And then after that, we'll all make suggestions and Chip can pick. Is that, Chip, is that fair? You get 3 weeks to buy the book instead of having to buy it in 1 week, but also you got to read all these ones. Are you going to be okay with that?
Do I have a fucking choice?
No. All right.
No, I didn't think so.
I've been calling on Deb first a lot. It's not fair. I'm going to call on David first now. David, what is your first suggestion for the next issue or the next episode of Manga Splaining?
It's funny you chose me first because I was going to counter-program what you two chose. So I'll just leave instead. I'm going to go with Delicious in Dungeon by Ryoko Kui. I think it's another book that there's nothing like it in American comics or like North American direct market comics, I feel. And it's really charming. So hopefully Chip likes it.
Could you say that title again for me?
Delicious in Dungeon.
Delicious in Dungeon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like D&D mixed with the Food Network.
All right. That's all I need to know. It sounds good.
They really wanted that D&D in the title without getting sued by Hasbro with Dungeons and Dragons. So it's not the most felicitous translation of the title, but I like it a lot.
Yeah.
Delicious in Dungeon is, and it's a good series. I think I'm glad you picked that. I'll have any excuse to reread that. That's really, really fun.
I think the French translation is Gluttons and Dragons, which works a little bit better.
Oh, I like that. It's got the good, the good bounce. Next up, Deb, what do you want the next book to be in Manga Splaining?
Let's see. To kind of change things up a little bit, maybe I'll do something that came out recently. Mermaid Forest by Rumiko Takahashi.
Oh, the re-release, the Viz release.
Yeah, it's a horror story.
Mm.
Oh.
And it's kind of like myth, and it's about a myth that if you eat the flesh of the mermaid, you'll live forever. So basically,
yeah, that's true.
This person like does this, and then you see him go through time, dealing with trying to find the mermaids.
Don't spoil it for me.
Yeah, it's kind of it's interesting because you know like Rumiko Takahashi from like Ranma One Half and Urusei Yatsura, which is just out and out funny, or like Mason and Kyoku, which is very sweet and still kind of like charming and funny. Mermaid Forest is dramatic. And scary.
All right.
Beautifully drawn.
It looks like it's Mermaid Saga now.
Mermaid Saga now. Okay, so we are going to... So for those of you playing along at home... and is it one volume or is it... No, it's two. There's two volumes.
Is the second volume not out yet?
It's out February 16th. So I guess, yeah, let's just do volume one. We'll save Chip's poor pocketbook.
Thank you.
This guy's got how many volumes of Sex Criminals we all have to buy, but no, we can't get a six-volume manga series.
Look, until that sweet podcasting money comes in, I'm on a limited budget.
Fair enough.
Chris, what's your pick?
So I was actually going to... David ruined my pick by picking Delicious in Dungeon, and I wasn't going to pick that, but I was going to pick... I'll tell you what it is, because maybe I'll pick it down the road a little bit. I have another book I want to do. But I was going to pick What Did You Eat Yesterday by Fumio Shinaga. And it's a manga that is very gentle, and it includes recipes, and it's like very slice of life, short chapters and things like that. But I feel like it's maybe too close to Delicious in Dungeon, which also has recipes, although in a very, very different way. So we'll skip it on that. The book I want to recommend, and I actually don't know if I've still got a copy here in the house, so that's exciting, is Helter Skelter by Kyoko Okazaki.
That's a good segue from Mermaid Forest.
So it's called, this edition's called Helter Skelter Fashion Unfriendly. And it's also kind of it's a psychological thriller, let's say. Okazaki is considered to be like one of the greatest creators of Jose manga, which is like the women's counterpoint to seinen manga, men's manga. And when I read this, it just fucked me up in a good way. Like, it was just like, oh wow, this idea, we have this idea of shoujo, of girls comics and what they are, and this lights that on fire in such a good way, such a smart way. So yeah, Kyoko Okazaki also hugely influential on so many mangaka as well. So I think it's a good foundational book, and I think Chip will like it. I think he will be upset by it, but in a good way.
Okay, good.
In the way that all of the readers, hopefully, that haven't read Helter Skelter before will also be. So so our first three books are Delicious in Dungeon, Volume 1, of many. It's an ongoing series. Mermaid Saga, of one of two, which collects the complete Mermaid books by Rumiko Takahashi, and Helter Skelter by Kyoko Okazaki. And those are going to be our next three titles. I'm very excited to see how everyone fares with those three titles. Chip, Chip, we've picked titles that we think you'll like. What do you think? How do they sound?
It sounds good. So are any of them complete stories?
Helter Skelter is absolutely complete.
It's complete in one.
All right,
and
cool.
Mermaid Saga is kind of like, it's a collection of short stories that like,
yeah,
go
you can
on
read
for
just
a while.
The first volume and be fine. It okay. won't feel like yeah. you're missing out. It's all it's right. more episode. It's kind of like Twilight Zone a little bit. Like it's okay. episodic.
Mm. All right, yeah, because I just don't want to end up in the Akira situation where
we'll try not to do that to you.
I'm gonna end up buying every volume.
I think there's more Delicious in Dungeon than there is Akira at this point, but it's sort of like Scooby Doo.
And they're okay. way cheaper. Yeah. They're way cheaper volumes than Akira, too.
They're like Scooby-Doo.
Like, you can just watch one and, like, you get it. You know, you don't have to
yeah.
follow
yeah,
the,
that's true.
Like,
that's
the
true.
Overarching hyper-narrative or whatever.
Yeah.
It's all actually right. interesting because Andrew read the first volume of that and he's like, yeah, it's nice and it doesn't really go anywhere. And I'm like, oh, no, it totally does, though. But it does feel very, like, much like it's your own world. Oh, we're discussing the book before we read the book. Maybe we shouldn't do that. Yeah, so we are... So that is just about the first episode of Manga Splaining, first official episode of Manga Splaining. I'd like to thank everyone for participating this week. That's awesome. I can't wait to not be the host next week. That'll be exciting. Whether we decide to do... Mermaid Saga or Delicious in Dungeon. I actually wanted to also do a shout-out segment because I know everyone loves talking about themselves and what they're working on, and we learned last week none of us like to do that. Do you have anything you want to shout out, whether it's your own thing or something that you came across recently that you you want to give a little nod to? Maybe another podcast even. Maybe we can get those reciprocal hits.
I saw this Alice in Borderland. Anyway, it's an adaptation of a manga in Japan, but it was pretty good. It's sort of like a post-apocalyptic, gotta team up to survive kind of show.
Okay.
Very violent, you know, very edgy, but really entertaining.
Netflix keeps recommending that to me. You liked it, eh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
cool.
Is it a Japanese show or a Korean show?
Japanese show. And really? Complete okay. in 8 episodes.
Mm-hmm. How about, Deb, you got a shout out, a recommendation, anything you might want to put into the world?
I'm super enjoying Blue Period right now.
Oh, yeah, you mentioned that. What's that one about?
It's about a boy, this high school boy. He's kind of like Kaneda, like kind of a delinquent, but he's very smart. And then he discovers art. He discovers painting. And then he goes through this whole period where he's trying to get into art school. Mm. So it's really touching because it's... it reminds me of going, you know, that moment in high school when you're getting ready, you want to go to art school and what you go through and trying to discover who you are as an artist. And it actually explains things like still lives and color mixing. And it's very, it's educational, but gripping. There's like volume 2 has this scene where he tries to convince his mother to let him go to art school that made me cry. It was so touching. It was so beautiful.
Chipper? Anything that's crossed your path recently you want to give a special shout out to?
You know what? Honestly, all I've been doing is watching YouTube clips of the UK Dragon's Den.
Really?
That's all I've been doing. These Brits pitching their terrible products awkwardly, and then these British judges just being like, "Well, I'd never." And that's it. That's it. That's every clip. So check it out. YouTube.com YOUTUBE.COM.
Is that just Shark Tank but British?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there's there's Dragon's Den in Canada.
Yeah.
Which is my entry into that world, which had Kevin O'Leary on it, who is like a shitbag, but not as big a shitbag as he is on Shark Tank.
Yeah.
Which I then discovered. And then, and I've run out of all of those, so now I'm watching the UK version, and also bits of the Australian version, which is actually too nice for me.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's my big shout out this week.
All right, I have been watching. I'm sad because I'm not in Tokyo, so I've been watching Midnight Diner on Netflix. It starts off with that like slow cab ride through Shinjuku. And Kabukicho at the beginning and plays the sad Japanese country music and pulls at my heartstrings every time. And two Netflix recommendations. There you go. That's the new basic cable is nice. Netflix. I also want to give a shout out to the resources that I found while researching this episode, exploring akira.wordpress.com, Kodansha website, a couple of less reputable websites that I will put links to in the show notes but not mention here just in case anyone's listening. But yeah, I appreciate that there's so many people that love Akira and have put so much work out there, and it made the research I had to do today to answer Chip's many, many questions so much easier. So I'm really glad. So with that, let's wrap up this episode. Mangasplaining episode number 1, Akira volume 1 by Katsuhiro Otomo, published by Kodansha Comics. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga Delicious in Dungeon by Ryoko Okui, published by Yen Press. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com. You can also follow along with our complete reading list at mangasplaining.com. Thanks to DADS for their musical accompaniment this episode.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy 5 or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.